From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. As we speak, voters in New Hampshire are casting their votes for their favorite candidates. With a weekend of marathon speeches, debates, and rallies behind them, White House presidential hopefuls wait anxiously for results to come in from today's first primary. In the Iowa caucuses last week, the young voter turnout tripled from 2004. Will the same happen in New Hampshire today? Here to talk to us about the youth vote that may make all the difference, we've got Jamu Green. She's a political consultant and former president of Rock the Vote. We're also speaking with Melissa Harris-Lacewell. She is a political and African-American studies professor at Princeton University. We're also speaking with two of her students. Jacob Aronson is volunteering for Democrat Bill Richardson, and Chris Neno is volunteering for Republican contender John McCain. Welcome, everybody.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
Jacob and Chris, this is your first time being in New Hampshire for a primary, and if it's anything like the times I've been there, there's a lot of energy. Chris, what are you seeing?
Well, yeah, there really are a lot of chaotic events going on, and on every street corner there seems to be some sort of sign waving or chanting going on. It's quite an interesting scene, to say the least.
Jacob, what about you? What's your impression?
Yeah, it's really amazing just to be up here and see all the excitement. There's just, you know, signs everywhere and, you know, people campaigning everywhere. It's a lot of stuff going on.
Melissa, why did you choose to come up with a group of students?
Well, again, I'm directing the politics department at Princeton this year, and we're working together with the PACE Center on campus to bring a group of two dozen students up here to New Hampshire, really to kind of see how democracy works. And what I'll say about how democracy works is it works on the backs and legs of young people. It has been astonishing to watch all of these young people. When we first got here, it was 10-degree weather. There were 6-foot snowbanks, and they were going up to houses, knocking on doors. I mean, it really is the end. Engine of democracy is the willingness of young people to give up their holiday break and to be in these kinds of places working for the people who they believe will make a big difference in the way our country is run.
Jamu, is this something that makes a difference in the big picture of politics, the way that not only young people vote, but the volunteerism?
Well, absolutely. I think the great thing about the primary process so far with the incredible results from Iowa is that now young people who are on the front lines of the campaigns, they're seeing it actually pay off. They're seeing the candidates address this generation as a powerful voting bloc. And in the past, it's been, you know, looking at the swing vote as soccer moms or NASCAR dads. I think 2008 really is setting itself up to be the year of the youth vote.
But you talk about 2008 as a year of young voters, but every year there's this marketing effort that goes out from nonprofits, media organizations, different groups, grassroots groups that say, okay, young people, rally, rally, rally. And I'm thinking of 2004 when there was a lot of hip-hop political action, at least in terms of P. Diddy being out there and Vote or Die. But does that really make a difference? What makes a difference in actually engaging younger voters?
I think a lot of people in the media have been cynical about the youth vote, but we do need to go back to 2004 and examine that there were 6 nonpartisan groups that spent about $40 million to reach out to the youth vote, and we saw their turnout increase significantly, up 9%. It was the driving group behind overall turnout in the 2004 elections. And then it was repeated again in 2006, where 2 million more young voters turned out to vote in the midterm elections than had in the previous midterm elections. And now followed up by the tripling of their turnout in Iowa in the caucuses last week, I think this is clearly a trend that, you know, has been incorporated by infusing pop culture, but really getting the candidates to spend their resources on this constituency has what really turned it around in 08.
Chris, what are you looking for this time? I mean, maybe describe what your duties are as a volunteer. Literally, what do you get up every day and do?
Well, it's a combination of the old sign raising, making calls to, you know, plenty of calls to voters around the state, and going door to door, and from time to time, I've posted some events that the senator will be doing in the next several days, just to make people more aware of what he's doing.
And I will say also, as part of the education here, we've watched debates together, we've had conversations, we've been, you know, kind of getting together and having breakfast and dinner, and we're really all trying to process together what it is we're seeing and what any of that means for sort of, if democracy is really working this well in this kind of concentrated place of New Hampshire, what does it mean for all of the other states that don't get this kind of attention? And I think that's also been a big story that the youth volunteers here have talked quite a bit about.
Yeah, fill us in a little bit more about that, because New Hampshire gets an almost unbelievable amount of ground troops, as some people call them, you know, really the retail democracy aspect of it. If you live in California, you're not likely to have someone just walk up to your door and say, hey, do you want to come out and vote? But if you live in New Hampshire, there's probably a fairly good chance that somebody will drop by, at least drop some literature, you know, personally and make a little house call. How are things different, and how are you talking to your students about how things are different in New Hampshire?
Yeah, in fact, there's a fairly good chance in New Hampshire that three people will come to your door at some point over the course of a couple of weeks. You know, again, the idea here is that the people of New Hampshire, I will say many of the students have met lots of sort of ordinary New Hampshire voters and will tell you that these people take very seriously their role as national surrogates. They recognize that the work that they're doing in choosing a nominee. But that said, we don't want surrogates in our democratic process. We'd like to actually be able to make these choices ourselves. And getting to see how it works when you're having coffee, the candidate comes in, or you know, if you go you know, just 15 minutes to the local high school, you can listen to the candidate talk about their health care issues or their, you know, position on the war in Iraq. And when you think about the many millions of Americans who never have that opportunity, I think it almost makes you sad. And the students have talked a lot about the fact that this is the first time for them, if they're from other kinds of states, the first time they've ever had this kind of political experience, and how much they wish it was also a part of their own political socialization growing up.
Jamu, what can be done to really bring a sense of the vitality of retail politics to people who might not get to see a candidate? Is there a way to, you know, ways using technology or ways with outreach to really try to bring a little bit of that experience to other people in other areas?
Well, it's definitely necessary when everyone outside of New Hampshire and Iowa usually get to know the candidate sitting on the couch of the Daily Show or the Tonight Show, or what, in a sense, technology has brought to this cycle is they can get to know them a little bit better on the social networking sites. And MySpace did a debate earlier with several of the candidates. But really, I don't think any of these you know, mass media mediums comes close to shaking the hand and having a coffee or sharing a burger with a candidate at your community coffee shop. And that's why New Hampshire's first in the nation primary status is you know, a very special deal to the citizens. They take their responsibility seriously, and they really weigh each candidate, and they demand, I think, a little bit more than you can get on traditional mediums that the rest of the voters across the country basically have to get their information from.
Jacob and Chris, how are your friends getting information? I mean, obviously, you're working with Melissa, so already you're extremely savvy, let alone the fact that you're in New Hampshire and you're at Princeton. But for friends of yours, whether they go to school with you or whether they're friends from high school, what sources do they turn to, Jacob, to look for information?
You know, a lot of it is just, you know, going to websites, you know, either candidate websites or also places like YouTube, where, you know, a lot of candidates have posted videos. Otherwise, it's definitely from watching TV. Like she said, you know, Daily Show, Tonight Show, other things like that. But there's definitely not a huge, I don't think there's a huge amount of involvement to really go out of their way to find something.
Chris, I guess I'll turn the question around. If you had a chance to go on TV, and certainly you could create, we're hearing all the sounds of the election hub, by the way, but if you could create your own programming, whether it went out over YouTube or on broadcast television, what kind of thing would you create for people that you know, say, from high school? What would you want to broadcast?
Well, it seems that anyone who's watching YouTube among my peers are only seeing the candidates' gaffes and you know, never the straight message. And I think if I were working for a particular candidate, it might make sense to put those students on a list or, you know, something of that sort where they could get an update and, you know, see the latest campaign speech or the newest policy position. I think that might be a great way of spreading information that those students want to hear.
Melissa, before we let you guys go, what are you looking to get out of this as someone who teaches the next generation of future voters, political scientists, people who may have a citizen to government relationship or someone who's a leader in politics themselves? What are you looking to create out of this time that you're in New Hampshire?
Well, sort of two things. I mean, one is I often tell my students, it's great to be a voter, please be a voter, but the best thing that you can do for your democracy is to plan to run for office. I don't care if it's dog catcher, I don't care if you're a Republican or a Democrat, but think about the possibility of infusing all of this brilliant new blood into politics. And so I really want the students to get a chance to see what it would mean to run for office. The other big part of it is simply that, you know, you always start with a cadre of interested, engaged, smart students who then have conversations with their friends, who then move out. I don't think we'll ever have the kind of turnout among the kind of under 30 crowd that you have in the 30 to 60 crowd. But you don't need that full turnout. You just simply need them to start developing what it means to be a citizen, to be engaged in your democracy, and over time they find a way to make sure that they are kind of the keepers of the new democratic system as we move, into their 30s and 40s.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
We've been speaking with Melissa Harris-Lacewell. She's a professor of politics and African-American studies at Princeton University, plus Chris Neno and Jacob Aronson, students at Princeton. They were all at our NPR election studios in Manchester, New Hampshire. And we also spoke with political consultant Jamu Green. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. It's time now for our Africa update. In Kenya, a disputed election has turned into a full-on government crisis. Hundreds of people have been killed, thousands more displaced. Now Kenya's President Mwai Kibaki has invited opposition leader Raila Odinga for face-to-face talks. For the latest developments, we've got Edmund Keller. He's a professor of political science and director of the Globalization Research Center on Africa at UCLA. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you here. So the president is ready to talk. How has the opposition responded?
Well, the opposition initially said that talks were out of the question, but now it seems like Raila Odinga, the leader of the Orange Democratic Movement, now is ready to talk, he says, unconditionally. So that's hopeful, but I'm not quite sure what will happen as a consequence of that, because we're really talking about a constitutional issue. Kibaki has been declared the winner, and now in order for that to change, they'd have to have some kind of intervention from a constitutional court, maybe. They might recount the ballots. They might call for a new election. I'm not sure.
Who else has a hand in this? Could outside governments be involved? How many different entities could ultimately try to help shape what's going on here?
Well, ultimately, it will be the Kenyans who will decide what will happen. It's good to bring out in outsiders to possibly get the two sides to talk with one another. But at the same time, the Kenyans will have to decide. I mean, you've got to understand there is a constitution in place. There are rules, there are regulations relating to how elections should be conducted. People are talking about a coalition government, so a shared governance in Kenya. But what then happens to the Constitution? It's a difficult situation.
Archbishop Desmond Tutu of South Africa has come in and met with President Kibaki and Raila Odinga. Is this a situation where what some people have often asked for on the continent of Africa is happening, that you have one group of peacemakers coming into another situation, or is this muddying the waters?
Well, certainly this is a common practice for outsiders to come in and to try to mediate a situation. Tutu certainly has the standing, the international standing, to be effective in this situation. But again, Kenya's a sovereign country. Kibaki is still the president, and he can, you know, make a decision as to who can come in and what their roles can be. As I understand it, Kibaki would like to have the dispute mediated by the Intergovernmental Agency for Development. Odinga would like to have the African Union come in, and somewhere in between, they're going to have to come to some kind of an agreement. But certainly a high-profile, eminent person like Desmond Tutu, and even our own Jendai Frazier, Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, could at least keep this particular conflict on the international agenda.
How has this had a ripple effect? What's going on in Kenya? Has it had a ripple effect around the region?
Oh, absolutely. Kenya, of course, is valued in the region because it's a major transport highway for goods coming in by sea, by air. And those goods end up going to neighboring countries like Rwanda, Burundi, Uganda, all of whom are landlocked countries. And with the disruptions taking place in Kenya, nothing is moving. The ports are backing up, and the economy, of course. The economies of all these countries are negatively affected.
What about the long-term economic growth in the region? I mean, there are certain countries that act as these hubs, as you mentioned, for trade. Is this going to set back Kenya, not just immediately, but in the long term economically?
The United States doesn't have a great deal of corporate activity inside Kenya, but the European Union countries do. Many of them are involved in the tourism industry. And, of course, if Kenya's tourism takes a hit, well, then, of course, it's going to affect, as I say, the whole region in terms of the economic future of the region. Kenya is important to the United States mainly because of its geostrategic location. East Africa has been a sort of training ground for terrorists on the African continent, and this instability, of course, will even further that situation.
Are we talking in this case mainly about terrorists who are born and raised in Kenya, who are Kenyan citizens, or people from other regions?
They could be from other regions. Mainly they could be from any of the Persian Gulf states, on the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, from Oman, from Zanzibar, from even from Somalia. All of these folks congregate along the coast in Kenya. Kenya, as I said, is wide open. A foreigner can come in and set up business, marry into a local family and so forth and so on, and go undetected for a long period of time.
Is that, in your opinion, these geopolitical factors, the main reason why the U.S. would get involved as opposed to humanitarian reasons?
Oh, absolutely. The humanitarian aspect of it would come in, but only because you could render a certain amount of stability as a consequence of alleviating some of the suffering that's going on. But Kenya is seen as a major partner for the United States in the war on international terrorism, and that's mainly why the U.S. would become involved. It's had port access rights for more than 20 years at the port of Mombasa, but this whole effort in trying to combat international terrorism is something relatively new, but Kenya is central to whatever the U.S. is trying to do in Africa.
There's been a lot of coverage of the fact that Senator Barack Obama's family, at least part of it, is in Kenya, mm-hmm. his paternal side, mm-hmm. and that they have been members of his family and his ancestral village have been watching what has been going on in U.S. politics. Do you think the fact that Senator Obama is from Kenyan heritage makes people look at this at all differently or more closely?
Well, I would think that it would, you know, Kenya would resonate more as a consequence of Obama being from there. It certainly helps in terms of keeping this tragedy on the international agenda. And perhaps if we can keep it there, there might be a movement towards some kind of a resolution. Sure, I think the fact that Obama's family is there heightens the attention given to the problem.
And what do you look ahead for? Meaning, what kind of developments are you expecting to happen, or what possible roads could this take?
Well, I the future does not look rosy because hardliners on either side want to continue this conflict until they get what they want. I would hope, though, that there could be some enlightened leadership on the part of the ruling party and also on the part of the opposition. But the ruling party has, from the day one, been trying to push the envelope. Kibaki was sworn in within hours of the vote count being announced. Now they're planning to open up parliament next Tuesday. And if that happens, I mean, you know, it's sort of an acknowledgement of the legitimacy of the election of Kibaki. And so, you know, it'd be hard to push that genie back into the bottle.
Professor Keller, thanks for coming into our studios.
Thank you.
Edmund Keller is a professor of political science and director of the Globalization Research Center on Africa at UCLA. Now major efforts are underway to bring food and supplies to the roughly 250,000 Kenyans displaced by the post-election violence. For the latest on this growing humanitarian crisis, we've got Cassandra Walden. She's Chief of External Communications at the United Nations Development Program. Hi, Cassandra.
Hi, Farai.
It's great to talk to you again, and let's start out with a little bit from Wangari Maathai. She is a Nobel Peace Prize winner from Kenya. She spoke recently with the BBC about the crisis. Let's take a listen.
People are dying. People are now in refugee camps. They are hungry. People are not able to travel. I mean, there are hundreds of people out there who are suffering.
So, Cassandra, can you describe the refugee situation in Kenya? Who's going where and what are they looking for?
Yes, I can tell you that certainly the violence that took place immediately after the elections has caused about 250,000 Kenyans to move around the country. You have about 300 deaths, and you find people in the Rift Valley still very much on the move. You have a lot of movement of people in and out of Nairobi, and the UN, as tensions in the capital and elsewhere have eased, has been working to really step up its efforts to get the needed supplies to these moving populations.
So, can you describe what the camps that have been set up are like?
I can tell you that currently, for example, the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, is working to set up a camp in Eldoret, which is in the Rift Valley, where 22,000 internally displaced people will be located. They're providing emergency water and sanitation and really trying to get the basic needs of these populations met. You can imagine people just moved away from their homes, moved away from everything that they had known because they were concerned for their safety. So they just pick up, take their children, take whatever they can carry on their backs, on their heads, and move. And so we've got to, the United Nations has to work with the Kenya Red Cross and with other partners to ensure that their basic needs are met at this very crucial time.
Now, there are different aid groups that are going into Kenya to try to help out with this crisis. What specifically has the United Nations and the United Nations Development Program decided to do?
Yes, well, the entire United Nations working together, I mentioned UNICEF, the World Food Program, for example, has been moving convoys of trucks, supplies for displaced people in the Northern Rift Valley. Again, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees has told us that 3,000 Kenyans have actually left the country and moved to Uganda, and they need assistance. So UNHCR, the High Commissioner for Refugees, is working with the Ugandan government and the Uganda Red Cross to ensure that their needs are met. It is still very early days, and we are concerned about ensuring water, sanitation, shelter for these individuals, for their most pressing immediate needs. And we have a great concern for women and children who bear the brunt of violence. Children, for example, a number of them have been separated from their families, and we want to ensure that they can be reunited. We want to look at the situation with women who might have been subject to some sexual violence.
When you look at the medical crises that are arising or could arise, what are you really looking out for?
We're concerned about ensuring that people have clean water, that they have safe food, that they have shelter. You know, people are sleeping out in the open in some of these areas, and that's another major concern.
When you look at where people are moving, are some of them moving over national borders into other countries? And if so, what's that doing to the situation?
I mentioned earlier about Uganda. The High Commissioner for Refugees tells us that you have about 3,000 Kenyans who've moved into Uganda, which is a very strange situation for Kenya to be in, because Kenya has traditionally been a country that other refugees came to seek safety and peace. And so now you have Kenyans who've had to leave their country to find safety in Uganda, and we are working with the Ugandan Red Cross to try to assist those individuals.
Now, could this really impact the ability of the United Nations or other humanitarian organizations to deal with other nations? What I mean by that is, if you've got a whole new need that's arisen in Kenya, then there's got to be a redistribution of resources. Is this going to upset the balance of how you're approaching other issues in other parts of the region?
Listen, I think at this stage, it's still very early days to determine exactly what the impact will be. At the current time, we're just looking at the immediate needs of the displaced people. We certainly have concerns about what the impact of this crisis will be on other parts of the region. As you very well know, Kenya is in a very complicated neighborhood. Kenya has often been the transit point for supplies and personnel moving to some of the countries in the neighborhood who have not been as stable and as lucky as Kenya has been in terms of being a stable multi-party democracy. So that you find that those supplies destined for Congo, those supplies destined for southern Sudan, the supplies destined for Somalia during the time of the violence were actually delayed. They were stuck at the port of Mombasa. They were stuck on the road and could not move into those countries. So that is an immediate impact of the crisis. You know, the United Nations working together, the humanitarian coordination, UNICEF, World Food Program, UNHCR, all of the agencies working on these issues will have to see what the long-term impacts are. But I can already share with you what we've seen as an immediate impact so far.
This is not a nation that you're just talking about academically. You've been to Kenya many times. What are your impressions on a personal level, and what does the country mean to you?
Well, I have had a chance to travel there numerous times, both in my official capacity working with the United Nations and also on vacation and to visit friends. And it's a country which is very close to me. As I mentioned earlier, it has an important role to play in the region. Kenya is a major hub for all sorts of supplies, for business, for education, for transit around the region. And I've experienced that both in my personal life and in my professional life. Your listeners may not know, Kenya sends more students to American universities than any other African country. And so many of us have Kenyan friends who have studied in this country. I was actually planning a trip to Kenya next year for some friends and family, some of my family who had asked me to plan a visit to Africa, and Kenya is one of the countries that I had put on that list. And as I'm sure your listeners know, Kenya is a great tourist destination as well as being a great hub for business, for transport, for education, etc.
Well, Cassandra, thank you so much for the update.
Thank you, Farai. Great to be with you.
Cassandra Walden is Chief of External Communications at the United Nations Development Program, and she was at our New York studios. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. He was the first black writer to hit the American bestseller list. The grandchild of slaves who grew up with few years of formal education and a magnet for admiration and anger. We're talking about Richard Wright. His memoir, Black Boy, was labeled obscene by a Southern senator. Black Boy and Wright's novel, Native Son, remain favorites on college reading lists. Richard Wright died in Paris in 1960. His daughter, Julia, found one last work in his office. The unfinished manuscript was titled A Father's Law. It takes a look at a black policeman and the son he suspects of murder. This year marks the 100th anniversary of Richard Wright's birth, and his daughter has published A Father's Law. Julia Wright told News and Notes why she believes putting out A Father's Law helps her cope with her father's death.
I knew what it had brought me. It was a gift to me. It brought me out of my mourning. I had a sort of a feeling of sisterliness to Tommy. I had a feeling of compassion for the policeman father. I had a feeling of total understanding. It was like a long letter that he had written to his family and not posted because he hadn't had time.
Let's jump in briefly. Sorry to interrupt you.
You mentioned
Tommy, who is the son, without giving too much away, the somewhat troubled, enigmatic son of a black police officer, Ruddy. You say you feel sisterly towards Tommy. Other people might not want to claim him because he does have a lot going on. Why don't you just tell us briefly a little bit about that family, Tommy, the son, his father.
The marvel of that draft is that everything is seen through the eyes of the police chief, the black police chief. Everything this black police chief sees could be true or could be a dream. That's what I love about that book. I feel sisterly towards Tommy in the same way I feel sisterly towards Bigger. These are paper sons of my father's. I recognize Biggers when I see them.
So you mean
that
there's
only in America.
There's a lot of people who remind you of Bigger Thomas from Native Son.
That
doesn't scare you?
They don't scare me, no. No. They don't scare me. What scares me is what has been done to them for them to behave the way they do. What is it that is so cruel and inhuman that has been done to a human being to turn that human being into a violent, unfeeling person? If you look at all my father's heroes, tragic heroes, Cross Damon and the Outsider, Bigger Thomas, and many others, Fred Daniels in The Man Who Lived Underground, you find that he takes them to their breaking point. And his message is, we live in a society that takes us to our breaking point. What do we do when we break down? Of course, in this case, we don't know what the way out is, and that's the second mystery, because my father died before he could complete the draft.
Ms. Wright, let's talk a little bit about the big picture of your father's creativity in his life. You mentioned the male characters like Bigger Thomas and Native Son. What about the women? Your father has been accused by some of being misogynist because he creates women and then kills them in terms of the characters. Is there any question in your mind about how he related to women as foils for these men who were such strong characters?
Well, I could answer that in various ways. I could say, first of all, that the attacks that came against my father's women characters were attacks that came during the rise of black feminism in black American literature. That has somewhat passed. Secondly, I think the person my father loved the most in his whole life was a woman. It was his mother. And I see this last unfinished novel as an expression of his own mourning, the mourning of the death of his mother, Ella, who was living in Chicago and who died of a stroke in 1959, in January, I believe. And he started writing a father's law a few months later.
It's your father's centennial of his birth.
Yes.
What footprint did he leave in history?
Oh, that's a beautiful question. It's the footprint of a seer, like in Black Power, which he wrote in 1953, and the movement that followed, like the flood stories in Uncle Tom's Children and Eight Men, which, if you reread them, give you goose pimples because it's Katrina, like a father's law and all the depiction of syphilis because AIDS is just around the corner. The way he saw so far ahead.
Well, Miss Julia Wright, thank you so much.
Thank you, Farai.
Julia Wright is the daughter of the late writer Richard Wright, who was born 100 years ago this year. Wright's unpublished novel, A Father's Law, is out now on Harper Perennial. Julia wrote the introduction, and all this year she's spearheading a centennial celebration of Richard Wright's work. She joined me from Studio Line in Paris. During this election year, we get a chance to see how political issues affect each state and affect African American communities. So, given that today's the New Hampshire primary, it's time for a check-in on a state where only 1% of the population is Black. But we found two folks who can give us their insights. Wayne Jennings is chairman and CEO of the New Hampshire Cultural Diversity Awareness Council. He's a Republican, and Wanda Mitchell is vice provost and chief diversity officer at the University of New Hampshire. She is a Democrat. Welcome, folks.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for having me on.
So let's jump right in here. According to the Census Bureau, there are just over 1.3 million people in New Hampshire. That means there are just about 1,300 Black folks in the whole state. So first of all, we're really glad we found you. Wanda, what are the roots of the Black population in New Hampshire?
Oh, I think they come from various areas of the United States. There's definitely Southern roots and Midwestern. And many came to the state because of the military, Pease Air Force Base, and the Naval Shipyard.
So let me go to you, Wayne. When you think about New Hampshire, do you consider it liberal, conservative, moderate?
I would say moderate. Moderate, but it started to lean towards being a little bit more liberal. When I came here, it was very conservative. There was no such thing as civil unions. And now that bill has passed, the state is starting to become more liberal.
When you think about the fact that you're a Republican, one thing that's come up recently as people look at Iowa and New Hampshire is the idea that Iowa is a place where Republicans tend to be social conservatives, New Hampshire is a place where people tend to be fiscal conservatives. Do you find that's the case?
Yes, yes, yes. I mean, you look at how the state government here is run, they're very, very tight, lean and mean. State reps here, I think, get paid about $100 a year, whereas you look at some other states in Iowa, because I don't know what the salary is for state reps up in Iowa, but I'm sure it's significantly more than what is paid to the state representatives here in New Hampshire. And that's just how things are run here.
Wanda, you're working in diversity in a university context. What does that mean? I mean, when the state has so few African Americans, so few people of color in general, what's the population at the university? Are there a higher percentage of students who are Black, Latino, Asian, Native American than in the state population? And what do you do to try to foster understanding?
Well, our student population, undergraduate and graduate, is about 6.3%. So that definitely exceeds the state, percentage. What we do at the university is that we try to practice and try to have strategies and initiatives in place that will make this a welcoming environment, not only for racial and ethnic minorities, but for all of our members of underrepresented groups at the university. Now, is this a challenge? But one thing I think we recognize at the University of New Hampshire is that we're not competing for this diverse excellence through diversity by looking at our state demographics. We are competing nationally and internationally for the best and brightest minds as it relates to our students, our faculty, and our administrative staff.
One of my favorite moments was being in New Hampshire for the 96 campaign, and Chris Rock was doing a little bit of commentary for Bill Maher, and he was doing a stand-up out in the cold, and he said, I'm in New Hampshire, and I can say with absolute certainty that there are no black hair care products in New Hampshire.
That is incorrect.
you have to search hard to find them, but they are available.
They are available. And, you know, those are some challenges that we face coming here. You're talking about issues not on the political, professional perspective, but on personal. Where to go to get your hairstyle? Where do you go to hear a full vocally gifted gospel choir? Those are some of the challenges and questions that I asked once I got here. And also around the housing community, looking at the composition of the neighborhoods, but also affordability. The cost of living is quite high in this northern New England state. And then that impacts our ability sometimes to recruit and retain diverse faculty and administrative staff.
Wayne, I'm assuming that you enjoy living in New Hampshire. Certainly, you've got a great job, and I'm sure you've got a lot of positives in your life. But there's a story that you know of about a friend who's a state trooper in New Hampshire. Tell me that story.
Yes. Well, a few years ago, this state trooper was driving his cruiser on one of the interstates here, and then he gets a call, and the dispatcher asked him if he was okay. And he said, sure, I'm okay. And then she said, are you sure? And she said, yeah, I'm fine. And then she says, well, we got a report that there's this black guy driving the cruiser. And we thought one of the cruisers was stolen. And so then he responded, well, guess what? That's me. Yeah.
Was he bitter after that, or how did he take it?
No, he just recognized the fact that it had to do with lack of exposure and the fact that it's a rarity to see a black law enforcement officer here in New Hampshire. And by the way, I run into the same thing also. I'm a volunteer firefighter in my town, and in terms of emergency services, there's only two of us here in the state, myself and a professional firefighter over in Dover. And I can't begin to tell you the number of times when people have given me looks when I responded to a fire and I was operating the pumps, or somebody had come up to me not too long ago and said, you know, you're the first black person I've ever met, and I just want to tell you what a great experience it is, and you really have changed my attitudes. And I said, okay, this is interesting. So then that got me thinking.
You're like a little ambassador. Does that annoy you?
Well, it used to, but now I understand it. And I'm glad that I did create a positive image rather than them having a negative image. And I one of the things that I do is I do my best to recruit and encourage other black professionals to New Hampshire. And the reason for that is because they bring something to New Hampshire. They can help with economic development, bring their professional skills. The kind of people that I don't want to see coming here are the criminal element, the kind that live off of social services. Those are the kind of people I don't want to have coming here because they reinforce a negative image.
Well, Wanda, in our state where there's no taxes, I don't think the people who would benefit from welfare or social services would find New Hampshire being a welcoming and embracing state because it would not really be resources available for them. But my perspective, I guess, is a little different because in higher education, just a matter of 3 years ago, the university system hired its first African-American woman college president at Keene State. And I saw that as really a move in the right direction, and the system recognizing that leadership comes from all perspectives, educational backgrounds, experiences, and cultures. And I thought that was a very positive a move.
Absolutely. And Wanda, just to add to that, I like to see more of that. I like to see the same school districts that give their kids the day off on Martin Luther King Day take the initiative to go outside of New Hampshire or go to the University of New Hampshire, recruit, hire, and retain African-American school administrators, teachers, and especially school superintendents. There's never been one hired here in the state.
Wayne and Wanda, we're going to have to wrap it up there, but we're really glad to have your perspective on. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Wayne Jennings is chairman and CEO of the New Hampshire Cultural Diversity Awareness Council, and Wanda Mitchell is vice provost and chief diversity officer at the University of New Hampshire. Both talk to us from New Hampshire.
Rock, jazz, urban, classical, world, folk. Discover old and new favorites in a variety of genres at NPR's music website. That's at npr.org/music. Upon a broken guitar.